Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Education spending and property taxes are a key issue in the new legislative session. There are projections it will take an 8% increase in the statewide property tax rate to meet the proposed spending needs from schools all across the state. Governor Phil Scott says he'll strongly oppose any increase in the statewide property tax rate and that the solution to this problem is a reduction in spending.
This year, we have an even more urgent need to act. And I look forward to working with you to find solutions, because if we don't, we face a significant statewide property tax increase. We cannot let this happen. Vermonters can't afford it. The state cannot sustain it, and I will not accept it.
Will lawmakers go along with the governor's approach? And if they do, what does it mean for local school budgets? And has the time come to make some big changes in the way that Vermont finances education? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. Lieutenant Governor, great to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So let's start off this idea of school spending. The governor likes to talk about the challenge facing Vermont schools. School enrollment is down roughly 20% over the last 15 years, but budgets continue to go up. He says it's totally unsustainable. Is he right? Is spending the problem that faces the state?
Well, I would say he's right halfway in that it's both a spending problem and it's a management demographic problem. And where are the resources coming from? Right now, we have 70% of Vermonters essentially paying for our education system based on income. And we have 30% of Vermonters who are not. And that is the wealthiest 30% of the state. They are paying based on their property value, and the math works out that they're actually paying a much lower percentage of their income than the rest of us who are paying based on income. There's a bill that Senators Polina and Pearson and others have introduced in the House as well that I think is going to get more a greater scrutiny this year to say, wait a minute, why is it that wealthier Vermonters pay less as a percentage of their income than everyday hardworking Vermonters making, you know, hourly wages of $10, $15, $17 an hour. That alone is not going to change. It's a tax shift. It's not going to change how much revenue comes into the state, but it would change who's paying and who's feeling that hit. And that's one piece. I would also say on the spending side, there's no doubt we need to look at that. And as a member of the Education Committee for 4 years in the Senate before I was elected Lieutenant Governor, I was bringing up the idea that our human services budget, which is the largest section of the state budget, our education budget, which is the second largest, they're both well over $1 billion, $1.5 billion, almost $2 billion, they actually overlap in some of the services they provide. Many of our teachers are now being asked to be part-time social workers, addressing some of the kids' needs in the schools coming from families that sometimes are a little bit challenged, either economically or because of mental health issues or because of demographic issues. There's all kinds of different reasons. And so we're duplicating services with human services, helping those families, and the teachers working with those kids. That's actually where some of these staff-student ratios have gotten to be where they are today. And the governor has talked about changing those numbers. But let's look at what changing those numbers really means. What that means is there will be fewer resources in the school to help those kids who are struggling and challenged. Well, what does that actually mean for the families that don't have kids that are struggling and challenged? What that means is their kids will get less attention. Their kids will get pushed a little less to go farther. The reason is the teachers are still going to have to make sure to bring the challenged kids up to grade level and up to par. That's part of the all the different standards that are out there, and that's also our social value system is to help those kids. But that means the teacher's going to have a little less time to push another kid who's doing well to go a little farther. Those are the kids sometimes that are the future entrepreneurs. Those are the kids that are the future leaders. And do we want to actually cut in a way that's going to hurt them? The other piece, Bob, sorry to be a little long-winded here, is that our rural areas will suffer more than some of our more, quote, urban areas with some of those ratio numbers that he certainly talked about if we sort of mandate that from the state level, simply because of demographics and numbers. Rural areas typically have a slightly higher or lower ratio, I should say, because of just demographic numbers. So before we just use sort of rhetoric and say this number has to be changed, we have to look at what the consequences of those are. And I think it's more of a long-term process, and I'm sorry that it's long-term. I've been trying to work on it for 4 years. We haven't seen the agencies budge. But as an administration, really tackling, is there an overlap of services between human services and agency of education and our teaching? Are they duplicated, and can there be savings found by bringing some human services work into the schools where there's got to be space if we've got so many fewer students? And then just the last statistic I want to put out there, the governor has talked a lot about his 6-3-1 numbers, and 3 being the number of students we're losing every year. And you talked about the 20-year trend. But in the last 3 years, we're actually now losing a little over one student. The number is 1 per day, not 3. And so does that mean it's a good thing? No, we're still losing population. We don't have as many families here. We need more economic development opportunities for young families to have more, you know, be here and bring children into the schools and help our overall tax base, as the governor's talked about. But it's also really important that we use accurate numbers, and we are becoming more stabilized on that number.
What would be the impact, do you think, on most local schools if there is no increase whatsoever in the statewide property tax rate?
Well, if the statewide rate stays the same, and it depends what the local voters vote, because if they vote the same budgets, then the local add-on rate is what will go up more. It's really which balloon. He's basically saying, I'm putting it out to the local taxpayers to make those cuts, which is a little bit of an abrogation of responsibility. Either have an idea that's going to actually show what the cuts are. Let's go out there and talk about them honestly and say, yes, if we're going to flatline this and not find the $80 million through the taxes, what specifically is the governor going to say should be cut? Is it the arts programs in your high school? Is it the remedial programs for kids that are struggling in fifth grade? I'd like to see what those specifics are rather than just broad-based language that makes everyone feel good but doesn't really address the specifics.
What do you think about an idea of the statewide health care contract for teachers?
Well, it's very interesting because that idea, which was brought out as like a shiny silver diamond, you know, let's save $26 million with 2 weeks left in the session on a topic that no one's really looked into the details on, that sure felt great. Everyone said, hey, what, we can save $26 million like that? But when you actually looked at the details, those savings weren't really there. And in fact, the summer committee that was the compromise put together, which frankly, that bill also is what's made it so we have this big tax increase, and I'll cover that in a moment. But that summer committee, which voted in a divided vote, actually found that it was complicated to make it a statewide, that the money may or may not be there depending on what you actually come up with as that contract. So even the findings of the committee that was predominantly folks he appointed indicated that there may or may not be those kinds of savings. Remember, if they go to the lowest common denominator, there could be savings. If they go to the highest common denominator, there actually could be costs. And, you know, most people don't give up the benefits they've had quietly. And I think it's fair to say, shouldn't we be aiming for everybody to have better health care, not be bringing down our friends and neighbors, whether they're teachers or other aspects of our community?
You talked about the staff to student ratios, and if you increase that ratio, how it hurts some schools in the rural parts of the state. You know, Vermont has a lot of small schools, and some people think that's the problem, that, you know, you have some grades with 4 or 5 students in the grade. Has the time come to look at this issue and decide that some of these small schools are going to have to close?
Well, that's obviously a very difficult discussion. And what I would say is the goal, and I did support Act 46, was to actually find the savings on the administrative side so that the schools wouldn't have to close. If you have 2 or 3 small schools that neighbor each other and they have 5 and 7 kids per grade in neighboring schools, why not, instead of having 3 K through 6s next to each other, have a K-2, a 3, 4, and a 5, 6, where the kids from different towns come together, and you would then have 12 or 15 kids in each grade. You would actually be able to maintain each school being open. There would be more transportation involved, but you'd actually have a better opportunity for those kids to work with more range of children. I mean, if you're in the same class with the same 4 kids or 5 kids for 6 years in a row, there's some stagnation there and could be some real challenges. So let's look at it administratively first. And obviously, frankly, Act 46, I know there's been challenging parts of the state, but far more districts consolidated administratively than we actually thought would. And that's a benefit. If you look at many other states or jurisdictions, 60, 80, 100,000 kids in a school district, they actually have one superintendent. I mean, some would argue, why do we have 60 districts? Let's have one. But of course, the counter to that is, well, some of our districts have school choice in high school. Others have school choice all the way through. Our districts operate differently. And I don't think anybody out there wants a top-down approach that says, guess what? No more independent schools. We're doing K through 12 everywhere. Or we're doing K through 8 everywhere and all high schools will be independent. That's what happens when you go to a single district across the state or even 5 or 6 across the state, unless they're managed that they don't have to be geographically next to each other. You know, we could say all K through 12 districts in the state have one superintendent, even if they're not abutting next to each other. If people want to go there, you know, light up the phone lines and tell us. I'm not sure the public's ready for that.
You mentioned Senator Polina's bill, which would have everybody pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of their property. It's estimated that if that system was put into place, it would raise roughly an additional $80 million a year. And Senator Polina wants to take that $80 million and lower the tax rate with it. But the bottom line is that wealthier people are going to pay more. You referred to it as a tax shift because a certain percentage of their income will be greater than their property taxes at the current time. So some people might be wondering, why is it fair to always ask wealthy people to pay more money?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that wealthy people do make more money, and there's those that argue that they make more money all because of that they work harder. Well, I think that's pretty insulting to the people that work 50, 60, 70 hours a week to make ends meet, and they're struggling to get their kids out the door to school, and they're juggling with their partner who may have a night shift versus they're having a day shift. They don't even see their partner sometimes. If we got paid based on how hard we worked, then a lot of working class people would be getting paid a lot more. So what we have to recognize is that some of the wealth that's generated in our community that certain people earn or unearned income is based on the work of other people. And they also earn that money on the infrastructure that we all pay for, whether it's our schools, whether it's our roads, et cetera. And they've reaped a greater benefit out of that through their hard work, their entrepreneurship, their ideas. And no one is saying they should just stop making any more money past $70,000 or $80,000 and they should just pay everything else to government. But what we are saying is the pain of running society would be more equally felt if we all paid as a percentage of our income. Remember, they would still have more income and they would still keep more of that income than someone who's making $60,000 and paying 3% for the schools versus someone who's making $400,000 and paying 3%. They'd still end up with a whole lot more money in their pocket. So the shift would say two things. Yes, they would pay more, and hardworking Vermonters would pay a little bit less.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Andy, who's calling from East Montpelier. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a question about the governor's idea to give free college tuition to veterans. I'm wondering why the veterans are valued, in this case, higher than the teachers or the police or the firefighters or carpenters or garbage collectors. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, Andy, I do appreciate the question, and I just have to clarify. I can't quite answer why the governor feels that's more important or not. That was his priority that he put out there, but I think you've laid out the question in a reasonable way. You know, there's some interesting circumstances there, and then people can draw their own conclusions. I heard yesterday from the Adjutant General that I believe we're one of only 3 states that do not offer that tuition-free benefit to Guard members. And he was arguing that, in fact, attracting people to Vermont to be in the Guard is difficult when neighboring states do offer that, and we do not. So part of it could be a question of, would it actually be an economic development tool, bringing these folks and their families to Vermont, and then federal dollars that come with those jobs? So I would look at it partly in that light. But equally, I think it's really important, as you point out, that a lot of other people who contribute greatly to our communities and our society don't get free tuition. Now, of course, Bernie Sanders, our U.S. senator, has talked about tuition and higher education being either free or far, far more affordable than it is today. And I think we all need to work towards that. I know our main topic today is not cannabis reform, but I would argue that if we had a tax and regulate system, after first paying for youth prevention, treatment, education, and law enforcement, that actually the bubble of tax revenue just from taxing cannabis, not the general fund revenue, but the cannabis revenue, should go to two endowments, the Higher Ed Trust Fund and an Economic Development Fund. So we have money going forward for economic development. But that half going to higher education would actually benefit all Vermonters' opportunity to go to higher education, not just a particular class or segment that we think is the favorite group of the day.
Andy, thanks for your phone call. Let's talk to Diane in Montpelier. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to get my 2 cents in for reducing the number of superintendents in the state and redistricting accordingly, however it works, whether by grade or, you know, as Lieutenant Governor was saying, or something. Just there are a lot of superintendents in the state, and I think it's we're paying out a lot of money for jobs that could be done by fewer people.
Well, I appreciate that, Diane, and I think it's important to recognize we've been having this conversation since long before Act 46. We had the REDS and the MUDs, which were acronyms for all kinds of different incentives that we tried as a legislative body to put out there for local districts who are facing annual budgetary crises to really look at how to save money administratively and merge some of those districts, which ultimately could either lead to fewer superintendents or at least fewer sub-district level managers. And that conversation was a hard one. Very few of those laws with those incentives ultimately triggered the conversations that we finally did achieve with Act 46. So I think if there's more people like Diane out there, and you bring that to your local school boards, and you then bring that to your local legislators, and the political folks in Montpelier hear of that, that either it will happen locally, because districts will look to their neighbors and say, how do we save this some more money administratively? Or if we hear it enough at the state level from more people. So, Diane, I think you've done exactly what I asked for, which is make your voice heard. And I will say one of the things that I've been trying to do as lieutenant governor is really we are lucky in Vermont to have such citizen engagement in our process. Folks know their local legislator. You see them at the dump. You see them at the local store, at the gas station, et cetera. And people do chime in, but more so than a lot of other states. But we still don't have as much citizen participation in our democracy as I would like to see. And so folks like you, Diane, saying that to your local school board and others and building that voice is what would ultimately lead to that. Because as much as people say Act 46 was this top-down statewide pressure on everybody, people have been clamoring for saving money in education and helping stop the tax rates from going up and tax bills from going up. And this is what we came up with at the state level. And if there's further suggestions like yours and people hear from more people that there really are too many superintendents and we could live with fewer districts and folks wouldn't be angry that, quote, local control was given up, then I think that issue could be on the table.
Let's briefly take a look at the marijuana bill that passed this week in the Senate, now is on its way to Governor Scott. We got this email from Jay, who wrote, does your proposal to tax and regulate, you want to have the full state regulatory model. This bill that passed is personal possession. You can have up to an ounce. You can grow 2 plants. But you want to go much further and have the Colorado model of tax and regulate, retail stores, taxation. So what Jay wants to know is, if your plan is put into place, the so-called tax and regulate plan, what will happen to people who want to grow their own at home? Will it be prohibited? Jay would like to know.
Well, actually, I have regularly supported pretty much the alcohol model in many respects, which is that you can brew your own beer and you can go to the store and buy it, because not everyone is going to brew their own beer. Not everyone either has the land or the capacity or the time to brew their own beer. And the same would be true with cannabis. So I would support, when we go to a tax and regulate model, to still allow folks to grow for their own personal consumption or to give to a friend or two. But I think we need both hand in hand. And I don't think it's actually that big a step to tax and regulate from this home grow model. Because ultimately, again, all three things, changing from the underground model to home grow and or changing to tax and regulate, is not going to be as big a change as people think, because there's already a lot of cannabis out there in Vermont and a lot of Vermonters already consume. It's just in the shadows. And this is going to bring it out in the open. It's going to add to our tourism economy. It's going to give us revenues for economic development. Maybe we would, with the Economic Development Fund, expand broadband for a couple of years, or put money into cleaning up brownfields like in Springfield, those incredibly beautiful buildings. What if they were cleaned up so the developer could put makerspace and draw in those 25 to 40-year-old demographic entrepreneurs who want to work in the tech sector and could then commute to Boston or Connecticut every few weeks to visit with clients? There's real opportunity here, not just with, quote, cannabis revenue, but the expanded tourism industry. But yes, you would maintain the home grow in my ideal world. I don't make that decision. The legislators do.
So Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper said the biggest mistake he ever made in the legalization of marijuana in Colorado was allowing homegrown when the retail market was put into place, because effectively he said, I'm supporting the black market. On one hand, I have tax and regulate. On the other hand, I'm letting people grow marijuana and they're just feeding the black market. So does that make sense?
Well, the underground market, which I think it's up to you if you want to change your terminology, but I try to use underground or illicit market rather than black market. The history of the drug war is very much racial identity. And so I move away from the term black market if possible. But the illicit or underground market in Colorado is now all grown in Colorado. It used to be imported, just like some is in different states. However, it's actually not so much a diversion from the home grow as it is the medical. Colorado has a very different medical system where one grower can grow for 100 patients, I believe, or maybe even more. So they may have a greenhouse full of medical cannabis. Some of it has THC. They can grow that. And all they do is sell some out the back door of the greenhouse at an untaxed rate. And that, in my understanding, is where the vast majority of the underground market comes from. You know, I do think it's important not to, you know, some say we want tax and regulate to just get all the money. And maybe that's part of what Governor Hickenlooper's perspective is not only about the underground market, but the sideshow of that would be get more tax revenue. I think because of our medical system difference, we would be avoiding a lot of that underground market diversion.
So Governor Scott says he is going to sign this bill. He's not sure that he's going to have a signing ceremony. Sometimes when there's a big bill that passes, the governor invites people into the ceremonial office, hands out pens after signing it. It seems unlikely that the governor is going to choose to have a public signing ceremony. From your point of view, is that an opportunity lost?
Well, I actually think it would be a great opportunity in Vermont, given the national political climate of divisiveness, of rhetoric that's just really undermining, frankly, our faith in our democracy, our faith in the parties and in how it all works. He could have a signing ceremony that would be tripartisan. This bill had tripartisan support. We would have people standing together, recognizing the failure of the drug war, at least the portion with respect to cannabis. And, you know, it could be something that would be, I would argue, harmonious and show the public that a Republican governor, a progressive Democrat, lieutenant governor, Democrats, Republicans, progressives in the legislature, the vast majority came together just as the vast majority of Vermonters, again, with very different political views, came together to support and would still support reform. So he has an opportunity. This could be a moment for him to really show how we work together, or he can pull it into, you know, the private office and do it on his own. That's his choice.
I wanted to talk about paid family leave. Last year, the House passed legislation creating paid family leave. It imposed a small payroll tax on all employees. I believe it's 0.15%. For a person making $50,000 a year, this would amount to about a $75 increase. Do you think the Senate should pass this bill this year?
Well, I think we have to look at both paid family leave and raising minimum wage. It's important to recognize that the paid family leave bill that came over was entirely taken out of the payroll of the employees and not the employers. But at the same time, if we have an increase in the minimum wage that, frankly, would be greater than that expense, everybody who's a working person would see a benefit. And those that it's very clear the governor is looking at the workforce and people not in the workforce, paid family leave is the biggest bill that would draw more women into the workforce. One of the reasons women aren't in the workforce has to do with the inability to juggle work and family and having a family. And paid family leave could help with that. So again, back to the governor's 6-3-1 rhetoric, if you want more people in the workforce, then attract them into it. And paid family leave would help do that.
So what I hear at the State House is either paid family leave can pass or increasing the minimum wage can pass. Now, the two bills are not linked in any way whatsoever, but there's sort of a general thought process that one can pass but not both. Do you think that's the situation?
Well, I think we're going to see how it comes down to the end game. I think there could end up being politics where the governor's really happy to watch the House bill, which is the paid family leave, and the Senate bill, which is raising minimum wage, ends up being a battle between the House and the Senate. I think that would be very unfortunate because, frankly, they both benefit both the employer and the employee from a returning employee perspective. If we have a better minimum wage, employees can stay in the same job longer, which as an employer myself, that would be a good thing. I have a hard time keeping employees in a seasonal workforce situation with the low wages that reality exists. So I think that's a conversation that is ongoing. I think it's, again, up to the public. And, you know, we have 70, I think, or 80,000 people that would be affected by raising the minimum wage over time. That's a huge number of our workforce that goes exactly to the affordability issue that the governor is talking about. You know, changing fees or taxes by a marginal percentage versus raising the minimum wage by, say, 4 or 5 or 6% a year, you know, 50 cents or 75 cents a year. That's going to make life far more affordable for far more families than holding the line on taxes and making cuts such as are currently presented in the Budget Adjustment Act of $200,000 to the temporary to renter assistance, for instance. The governor talks about making the state more affordable, but they want to cut $200,000 from renter assistance, which is exactly what's used for low-wage working families to make up the difference between what their rent is and what their income is with respect to 30% of their income going towards housing. I don't know how that jives with affordability when you're making struggling families have less opportunity to have help with their rent.
So if you had to choose between passing paid family leave and increasing the state minimum wage, which one would you choose?
If I had to choose, I would probably choose raising the minimum wage. I think that will affect more families and more affordability. And I speak to that as someone who is a small employer. I have employees who get paid the minimum wage. I recognize the impact it will have on my business in both directions. Sometimes people get very hung up on the $15. No one's talking about next January, the minimum wage being $15. That would put my business out of work. That would put a lot of small businesses out of work. What we're talking about is a steady increase towards making it so that people who work 40 or even 50 hours a week can ultimately pay their bills on their own rather than having to use the bureaucratic system we have now of taxing everybody to create money to pass through the bureaucracy and back out there to help low-income people afford to live in Vermont. For those who want smaller government, they should support raising the minimum wage because that is actually direct payments to employees from employers, but it makes it so that we can actually reduce the long-term government costs because we, as a rightly so, help people meet their basic needs. And I think that's what is common ground amongst people of all persuasions in Vermont, that if you're working hard, you ought to have a basic standard of living.
So how do you address the whole benefit cliff problem? So if you do raise the minimum wage for some people, all of a sudden some folks aren't going to be eligible for the child care that they get now, or perhaps Three Squares Vermont, the food stamp
right.
program. How do you change that?
Well, there's no doubt that what we have to do, and the benefit cliff is very real. I think it's at about 45 or 50,000, I'm not exactly sure, of income. You actually, if you make more money, you end up worse off because you start to lose some of those services and supports from the state. Well, what we need to do is consider maybe slightly trimming where that top benefits are, but also fill in the hole so that it's a steady slope upward, that if you make more money, yes, you lose some services, but the goal would be to lose fewer services than you're gaining by gainful employment, so that there's always the incentive to work, well, more, hopefully up to 40 hours, not 70 hours a week, and pay your own way. And there's no doubt that that's a real problem. Again, broken record, but I go back to a tax and regulate system on cannabis reform. There's also the general fund revenue increases that would come from that. You would have more jobs in bed and breakfasts. You'd have more jobs at the ski areas. You'd have more jobs at the summer recreation situations. And actually, as more people are working in Vermont, then more money is in the tax coffers of the state and finding the resources to fill things like the benefits cliff hole, which would then take away the disincentive to work more, would be a net gain for everybody.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Robert, who is calling from Barton. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My point is, and I'd like to commend the Lieutenant Governor for his comments and his support. The problem is not the rising cost of education in this country. Schools are labor intensive. That's a problem and a benefit. What is unsustainable is the gap of income that's occurring in the United States and continues to rise. That's where the emphasis of the governor should be, and not on schools, which are doing a fantastic job. Thank you.
Well, and Robert, I appreciate that. There's very clear statistics, and I've put out a graph on my website in an early newsletter. I should state I have a newsletter we put out every couple of weeks. You can go to the Lieutenant Governor website, ltgov.vermont.gov, to sign up for it if you want, and you can look at past newsletters. But one of them has a graph that shows that the increase in income or the non-increase in income over the last many, many years has been primarily focused in the hands of the wealthy. And of course, the bill that just passed in Congress and the president signed is only going to exacerbate that. So when people ask earlier, as you did, Bob, why should wealthy people pay more? Well, the way the system is set up right now, some would say rigged. I don't think that's quite fair. But the way it's been set up by those with money and therefore helping get people elected who are going to support it is to make a system that concentrates wealth into the hands of the few. Obviously, Bernie is the most outspoken and most eloquent on that. And we're in the land of Bernie, the state of Vermont, where he has tremendous support. So I think Robert's views probably would be reflected by the majority of Vermonters. And I agree with him. I would hope the governor would look at furthering a system where that money that is earned in Vermont is more equally earned and working people are not struggling as much.
Let's talk to Patrick, who is calling from Westford. Hi, Patrick. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. When it comes to affordability, especially for my friends who are renting in Burlington and Winooski, rental rates have just been skyrocketing. We see development, which has an emphasis on above-market rentals. So these are luxury condos, designed to attract high-income residents, which then have spillover effects, especially in the Old North End, which can lead to rising rent rates. I'm curious what Lieutenant Governor thinks about the possibility of rent control in cities where you have a majority of residents who are renters, which I think in Vermont is only Burlington and Winooski. Is it possible for the city, either of them, to institute rent control, or do we need some sort of legislative action or enabling at the state level to make that happen?
I think the communities have, through ordinance and zoning and so forth, the opportunity to do that, because I know certainly in Burlington, I don't recall if Winooski has inclusionary zoning, but I would argue and I would hope that communities that don't have inclusionary zoning would pass it. And what that means is when you build a development, that a certain percentage of it has to be affordable. So you might have a development of 20 units and maybe 20% of them or four of them would need to be affordable to a certain income threshold. Now, you can set what that income threshold is, and you can set what percentage of them have to meet that. And I think we do need certainly more inclusionary zoning and more that meets the needs of the lowest income folks. Whether or not the communities are ready for full-on rent control, I think that's always a discussion worth having. Generally, I think it's been found that that's been pretty difficult to pass. And just for full disclosure, I have two rental properties in Burlington. As I've bought and moved on, I've been able to hold on to to what I had before. I'm very fortunate in that regard. And, you know, I know as a, quote, landlord, that the landlords would say, oh, I have to increase it because my rent, my property taxes are going up. Oh, I have to increase it because my property taxes are going up. That's really not entirely true, especially for people that have had those properties for a long time, because their mortgages are relatively low. Yes, there's maintenance costs, but they're going that what drives up rents is market rate. It isn't the taxes. It isn't the maintenance in the vast majority of cases. And those landlords are gouging. And that's free market for all the free market supporters out there. That's great for the people that have capital, but it's pretty difficult for the people that don't.
So we got a tweet from Kip who would like to know if you would consider running for governor in 2018.
Well, Kip, that is flattering. I'm supposing that means you'd be supportive of that. And I thank you for that. I have been asked that a number of times as different groups come through the State House. And I was just talking to a group of Johnson State students that former Senator Doyle brings to the State House. And he's really done so much to add to democracy and civility in this state. It can't go stated enough. And someone asked me that same question. And I have to say that as a small business owner, my spouse, frankly, is compromised by Lyme disease. I have a 12-year-old who I honestly don't get enough time with. And as I look forward, you know, right now, the role of being lieutenant governor suits me well, not only from my own personal interests, because that was the personal side, but honestly, I think right now I can serve the state very well by, again, conversations like this with Vermonters, getting more people involved in the system. And, you know, I just don't think right now is the moment for me. Do I think someone, you know, could beat the governor? Sometimes, you know, political discourse. No one could beat the governor in their first term. You know, I think everybody can be beaten. I could be beaten. I think the discussion needs to be out there. That's what democracy is about. We do need strong people to run. And I do appreciate the support. This isn't the moment for me. I'm really working on sort of democracy, bringing more people into the system. And frankly, even with the cannabis bill, working on economic development, that's not only short term, but long term. And to go to, I think, Bob, you were going to say we're going to go towards water. If I can beat to the punch, you know, right now, the governor built housing last year with a housing bond. And then they're talking about doing water through the institution's budget and $10 or $20 million a year out of the institution's budget. What we do when we run government with debt in this way is really not the way to conservatively run government. You know, you don't borrow money to buy your groceries. Cleaning up water is an ongoing effort that's going to be for a long time. Yes, we could borrow money for the water treatment plants, but I don't think we should be borrowing money for every single aspect of water cleanup. We do need to pay as we go.
Well, let's look at one of those pay-as-we-go ideas. Senator Bray from Addison County, who is the chairperson of the Senate Natural Resources Committee, has got a plan that says, let's put a tax of $1 a month on every parcel of land in Vermont. Now, I think there are about 330,000 parcels of land of all different sizes, of course. So it would amount to $12 a year. Is that a good idea?
Well, I actually served on the Agriculture Committee when we passed a water bill a few years back, and we proposed a similar, but I think a cleaner system, which was a per parcel fee. I believe it was $25 per parcel. At the time, everybody was talking about all in. Everybody pays in. And the idea was $25 per parcel, although any parcel that was over 25 acres would pay a dollar an acre beyond that. And we might have done an adjustment for forest land because, frankly, it's more of a filter than a producer of water quality problems unless there's bad cutting management, which is rare. So I think for both the quantity of dollars and maybe it's soundbite politics to be able to say, you know, $1 per month. So that's not very much. You know, $25, I guess that's $2 per month. In urban areas, people would say, well, I'm not even an acre. Why should I pay $25? Well, that addresses some of the impervious surface issue and some of the urban runoff issues as far as proportional paying. And farmers would pay more because they have more land and there's some proportional impact, obviously, from farms. So I think there's a simpler, maybe he thinks that's more simple or more politically feasible, but a little more money would come from that original idea we had in the Ag Committee. Maybe it's one of those two kinds of things, but we do need to pay as we go and not keep borrowing from the future, which is what these different bonding systems do. And there's a really, you know, Governor Douglas did this as well. And the advisors to Governor Douglas are the exact same people that are advising Governor Scott. And they come up with the same ideas, which is pay a lot up front and borrow in the future to do it. And they've done that with affordable housing. Now they're going to do it with water. You're going to see it on issue after issue. And that's not the Vermont way. Let's endow the future to pay for going forward, or at least let's pay as we go. Let's stop borrowing from the future to meet today's issues.
So the Scott administration says they don't like this per parcel fee idea for a couple of reasons. One, it's a fee increase that doesn't exist now. Even though it's small, it is an increase. And two, they say administratively, this is a nightmare to try to do, that you're going to spend almost as much money administratively raising the money as you are raising money. And they absolutely don't want this to be an add-on to your property tax bill.
Well, and that's really a mixed set of statements. Why don't we go for the simple way, which is to do it as an add-on to your local property tax bill? Our town clerks know the parcels. They know the size of the parcels. So whether it's under the Chris Bray model or mine, it can be done fairly simply. Our local governments already send money in from the property tax bill to cover education. So it's not that complex. They know how to do it. And so he would rather borrow from the future. I would rather pay in the present. And I think that's where the money meets the road. And, it's important to recognize if we take $20 million a year out of the institution's budget, there is a consequence to that. And that consequence is going to cost us money. And it's going to cost us more and more if we don't address it, whether it's right now using money to expand our hospital beds and our mental health facility in the state. We all recognize we have a mental health crisis and that there are some acute patients that maybe ought to be in more beds, but we don't have enough beds. Well, if we don't build those beds, those costs are in the community. Those costs are in your local law enforcement. Those costs are in potentially tragedies that might occur, either individual harm or harm to others. Punting on mental health spending, some of which is through the institution's budget, or court safety. And we obviously had a tragedy a couple of years ago with our social worker, Laura Sobel, who was killed. If we don't invest in that, we're asking for trouble down the road, and borrowing it is not the way to go.
Just have a little bit of time left. Tell the person who lives in Brattleboro why they should pay a per parcel fee to help clean up Lake Champlain.
Well, I think that's the model of saying all water quality problems are only phosphorus in Lake Champlain. There's actually nitrogen issues in the Connecticut River. There are water issues all over the state. And frankly, our state is much better served with clean water because tourism for the state with clean water benefits everybody. So I think it's everybody's interest in clean water, and we can all do it together.
We'll be following many of these issues in the coming weeks at the State House. Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank the callers for participating as well.